Right, so there are a few more quizzes out. I'll collect them as you finish them, but I think we should begin. So this is our third guest lecture of the semester. And our guest today is Professor Steven Sekula from the physics department. He's going to tell you all about homeopathy.
Okay, so thank you very much. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. So I'm a particle physicist. What I do for a living is I study the tiniest building blocks of the cosmos that we know about in the search for the ultimate building blocks of the cosmos. And so I'm used to dealing with very, 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 very small things and their implications for big things like us, what I would call macroscopic things as opposed to microscopic things. And so homeopathy to me is a very interesting topic because it tries to cross a boundary between small things and their effects on the microscopic world, and then the implications that those have for the macroscopic world. And there's all kinds of chemistry and biology and physics that's laced into this. But what I want to give you a sense of today is just what is homeopathy, how did it originate, and can we demonstrate its efficacy or inefficacy right here in the classroom? Okay. So today we'll, based on the amount of coffee I've been drinking, end fairly dramatically. Okay, but what I want to begin with is just a simple question. So, has anyone in the room ever been knowingly or unknowingly, and then you found out later, been given something called a placebo? Yeah? Okay, you were the first hand up. So you got a sticker? All right, work on that. Okay, what's your name?
Gabby.
Gabby, okay, nice to meet you, Gabby. So, what placebo did you get? Oh, okay. All right. That's true. There's a placebo pill at the end of every cycle of birth control pills. That's right. That's right. And it's basically there. It's a sugar pill to fill the spot so that you don't get in the habit of not taking the medicine every day when you're supposed to. So it helps to regularize the process of taking something every day. Okay. So that's a very positive placebo because it reinforces a behavior in a positive way. Okay. Has anyone been given a negative placebo? You in the back, who's talking to Professor Scalise right now and not paying attention to me. Yeah, you. Yeah, graduate student. No, it's a grad student. He's in physics. He doesn't count. So, okay. No? Okay, well, so quite generically, there are many placebos in the world, okay? And whether you know it or not, you may have inadvertently been given one. So has anyone ever taken Zicam? Ever taken Zicam? It's a zinc. Yeah, you've taken Zicam?
Yeah,
okay, you take it a lot, all right? Guess what? You're taking essentially a placebo. Okay, now it does have zinc in it, which the claim is that zinc has been researched to show that it reduces the duration of cold symptoms. Okay, now the research on that varies, but it's maybe something like a third of a day, which for a cold sounds like it could almost be in the noise, but fine, okay? The key here, there are actual zinc lozenges on the market that you can go buy. I mean, for instance, if you do a web search, you'll find out that GNC sells these things, okay? The key here is that the word homeopathic is written in small print on the bottom right corner of the box. So next time you go to Target or Walmart or whatever, pick up a box of this and take a look. You'll see it's written right on the front. Well, what does that mean? Well, if there's any one thing that you remember today, let it be that what it means is that the company that makes Zicam is charging you 4 times more for 1 milligram of zinc than any real actual zinc supplement. And in fact, because they're a homeopathic preparation, they're not required to report their ingredients in the same way that actual medically applied zinc is supposed to. So they don't actually have to tell you how many milligrams of zinc they put in these things, which means it can vary from lozenge to lozenge, which means you may A, not be getting the appropriate dose, or B, if the manufacturing process is not well controlled, you may get a mega dose of something that you actually shouldn't be taking mega doses of. You may also be getting zero dose of something that you thought you were taking. All right, but the bottom line is if you run the numbers, and I did this last year for fun, and you have to back of the envelope calculate. They don't actually give you information about how much zinc is in these things. You have to guess. And you can make educated guesses, but it's still a guess. But based on that guess and being very conservative with my calculations, so erring on the side of them not overcharging you, they were still overcharging by a factor of 4. It's probably more than that. Okay, but 4 was the number I came up with. All right, so remember that. Homeopathic medicines, at the very minimum, are charging you more for things that you're getting less of than if you were to actually buy that thing from a licensed seller of the quantity in question. Okay? That's the thing to remember, number one. So It's a placebo. What is a placebo? A placebo, quite simply, is just something that you give to a person to make them feel better, but it has no actual medicinal value. Okay, it doesn't actually have a biological or chemical thing that it does in the body to ease symptoms, kill a virus, kill a bacterium, something like that. It comes from the Latin, I shall please. So it's right in the name, I shall please. Okay? So if a doctor gets a patient who's maybe a bit of a hypochondriac, not that guy who probably is going to drop dead on me during the lecture, you okay? Okay, all right. You know, you shouldn't come to class and get everybody else sick. Then that's on you guys.
Yeah.
So you're all getting projectile leprosy because of these two people. Okay. Right.
How about some Zycam? You want some?
Yeah, anyone want some Zycam? Or some Swedish fish. We got some Swedish fish. That might be just as good. All right. A placebo, you might think this is actually quite unethical, okay, but we've already seen one ethical application of a placebo. It's to help reinforce a positive behavior. So it can have positive ethical applications. Another positive ethical application that may seem like it's leaning toward the borderline between ethical and unethical is that a placebo can be used as a diagnostic tool. So if a doctor suspects that a patient just has a cold, but thinks they have influenza or something worse, SARS, okay, and they just want to see what happens to the patient if they're given something they think is a drug so that their body has time to just fight the infection or whatever it is, though often they have in the past, I don't think this happens too much anymore, not without your knowing, but you can give the patient a placebo and then wait a day, and if they get worse, then you know it's real, okay? But if they respond favorably, which sort of 20 to 30 to 40% of the population will without any actual medicine, then maybe it was just something that was going to clear up on its own anyway, okay? And that saves them money, it saves you money, all right? So you can use it as a diagnostic tool in a diagnostic suite, but if the person gets worse, you don't keep giving them the placebo. That would be unethical, okay? So, it's a tool that you can use as a doctor, but it's also something that can be used to part you from your money. And so this is where you have to be very, very careful with things like homeopathy, okay? So, what is the placebo effect? So, coupled to giving somebody a placebo is that they respond to it in some way, positively or negatively. The placebo effect is when a patient responds to that placebo as if they had been given real medicine. It's a powerful phenomenon. It's not a completely understood phenomenon, but because we know it exists, whenever you try a new drug on the market, you have to test against placebo, okay? Which means you have to give patients in a drug trial a pill or an injection, whatever it is, that looks identical to the actual medical intervention so that they think they're getting the real thing. They don't know whether it's the real thing or not, and then you take data to observe how they respond. And if the real drug does no better or does worse than placebo, then it has no medical benefit whatsoever. And in fact, it might have a negative consequence if it does worse. Okay? It's a real effect, and it's driven by our belief and our expectation in the outcome of a treatment. And it's a fascinating effect. The placebo effect is fascinating. Now, typically, it affects 20 to 30% of the population, but it depends on the circumstances. If you really believe in something and you're going to get better anyway, you'll feel better faster, and it could happen for 80% of the people in a trial who are receiving placebo, okay? There's a lot of research on this, all right? So I just put a few examples here, all right? So for instance, the frequency of intervention can have an outcome on recovery. So patients that got 4 placebo interventions each day over 4 weeks recovered about 20% faster than people who were getting 2 placebo interventions a day, okay? And it was a statistically significant number, over. So 20% better if you get twice as many placebo interventions. There's no actual medicine involved. It's your expectation that because they're having to take a pill 4 times a week or you have to go in and get a shot 4 times a week, that this is a serious intervention. If you're just getting it twice a week, it's not so serious, okay? Just the color of the pill can have a placebo effect. So in the United States, for instance, we associate red with a stimulating color and blue with a more lethargic, depressing color, okay? So for instance, medical students that were given placebos that were colored red and blue and then asked to identify which was the stimulant and which was the depressant, neither of them were stimulants and depressants, they reported that they got more of a stimulant effect from the red-colored pill and more of a depressant effect from the blue-colored pill because that's what they expected. So they just made a judgment based on the color that red means stimulating, blue means depressant. Turns out that people in Denmark have the same color associations, and so the study was repeated independently there, and the same results were found. But if you go to a population where those colors mean something different, you'll get a different cultural response because the expectation, the belief of the outcome is different. Okay? So there's a lot more resources on placebo. It's a fascinating effect. You could talk about it for an hour all on its own. So if you're interested in it, of course, the slides will be on the web. You can go and take a look at this review. It's lots of good resources in the bibliography for this if you're interested in doing a deeper investigation of placebo and, for instance, how it's used or abused in a pseudoscientific way. Okay?
Like for your final paper.
Like for your final paper. Hint, hint. Okay, but let's go on to homeopathy. So homeopathy will tie back to this placebo effect in a bit, but in and of itself, it's a fascinating subject. Now, what you have to keep in mind is that at the time that this idea was developed, it was a hypothesis. And like any other hypothesis, what matters is A, it's testable, B, it's falsifiable. Okay? So just to put this in perspective, at the time that Samuel Hahnemann, who originated the idea of homeopathy as a medical practice, at the time he was working, there was no germ theory of disease. We take that for granted today, that we know that tiny microscopic organisms use our cells as factories to reproduce. They blow the cells up, spreading more of themselves throughout our systems, causing widespread infection, and our immune system fights back with a variety of strategies to chemically and biologically destroy the invaders. Okay? That's the picture we have now, but that picture is built up on over a century of scientific research, of trial and error, of missteps and positive developments. It's like anything else in science. It grew over time from hypotheses to experiments, now to applications. Okay? But at the time Hahnemann was operating, there was no germ theory of disease. In fact, nobody really knew what caused disease. People got sick, and there were all kinds of different explanations, spiritual, biological, chemical, or otherwise. Okay? So, this idea originates around 1810 with this German physician, real physician, Samuel Hahnemann. Other pseudoscientific ideas don't often originate from people who are at least medical experts at their time. And the basic claim of homeopathy is that like cures like. So if you find a substance that induces the same symptoms as the disease that your patient has, you can use that substance to then get their body to fight. Okay, so like cures like. So if your patient is vomiting and you have Ipecac, all right, which induces vomiting, you might be able to use Ipecac to cure vomiting. It's kind of a weird idea, but at the time, absent any other evidence for any other idea, it's at least something to try, right? But it's without regards to the cause of the disease. You just find a substance that induces the same symptom set, and then you use it in some way to treat the patient. That's the idea, okay? So the other thing that happens here, and actually, you know, tell you what, can I give this to you for a second?
Sure.
All right, I got to go see a man about a horse. So I'll be back. I'm sorry. Actually, Professor Scalise knows the story anyway better about how Hahnemann came on this idea. I'll be right back. Sorry.
Turn off the mic.
Yeah.
A man about a horse.
Yeah. He's going to bring a surprise back. So what led Hahnemann to this bizarre idea that you should treat diseases with things that cause the symptoms, not alleviate the symptoms? Because surely, you know, if you have a fever, you'd want to take something to cool yourself down, not heat yourself up even more. Well, because Hahnemann was a physician, he had access to a lot of the latest cures at that time. And a lot of countries, England, France, had colonies in the tropics. They had colonies to grow spices and sugarcane in the tropics, where malaria was rampant. And there was a local cure for malaria, which was to take the bark of the cinchona tree and chew on it and just extract it. And today we know that as quinine. And it actually is effective against malaria. It can prevent it. It could also cure it if you have it. So Hahnemann had a large quantity of the quinine powder. So you take a lot of cinchona bark, you boil it, you get rid of the junk in the water, and you boil away the water, you're left with a white powder, and he had this concentrated quinine powder, and he decided, for who knows what reason, I guess in the spirit of experimental science, he decided to take a large amount of the quinine powder. He didn't have malaria, but he took it to see what would happen. And he started to shake, and he broke out in a sweat, and his face turned white. And he thought, well, that's strange. That's exactly what happens to people who have malaria. So the cure for malaria produces the same symptoms as malaria. That's where he got the idea that like cures like. Okay, that was a single data point. He had one data point from which he drew all of his conclusions. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Drank too much coffee. Okay, so let's go on. All right, so a little linguistic and historical aside, because it's important to know now in the modern era that homeopathy has survived, despite the fact that the germ theory of disease has been overwhelmingly successful at stopping plagues, curing new diseases, letting us develop new medications or new medical procedures to intervene in some kind of medical catastrophe or crisis. Homeopathy survives to the modern day, despite the fact that it has a one data point origin and it's been tested repeatedly since then. So again, homeopathy, proposed in 1810. Germ theory of disease was really first practically demonstrated by a gentleman named John Snow. Did you guys talk about the John Snow cholera outbreak?
Not yet, but we will.
Okay, great. So without giving too much away, basically, while there was a great deal of skepticism about this idea at the time, John Snow successfully applied the then very nascent hypothesis of the germ theory of disease to find the source of a cholera outbreak in London, in the Soho area of London in 1854. So this was the first recorded application of the germ theory disease to treat an outbreak of something as serious as cholera. This is cholera over here on the right, disgusting looking little thing, and does some horrible things to you, right? It induces a great deal of diarrhea, cramping, and eventually it dehydrates and kills you, which is obviously not a positive outcome. Now at the time, prior to 1854 or the late 1800s, cholera treatments involved some pretty awful things because the state of medical science was fairly poor by modern standards back then. Cholera treatments often involved taking patients into the hospitals, bloodletting them basically to get out the bad stuff that was assumed to be flowing through the body. Of course, what happens when you drain a few pints of blood from the human body is that you compromise its immune response and weaken the patient even more than they're already weakened by dehydration, and this, not surprisingly, led to a mortality rate that was about 50 to 60% for cholera patients in hospitals. Okay, in some sense, it would have been better for them to stay at home and drink water than it would have been to go to these awful places to die. And that's during an 1831 cholera outbreak. That was the mortality rate in the hospitals then. Homeopathic hospitals existed in 1831, and they boasted mortality rates of about 20%, so less than half the rate at which the cholera patients were dying in conventional hospitals. And I've already kind of hinted as to why that might be. It's because the interventions in conventional hospitals would be barbaric and stupid by modern standards. You're basically making the patients even weaker and less able to defend themselves. These hospitals were typically cleaner. They didn't bloodlet. And so, of course, the patients with some water and care got better at a higher rate than they did in the conventional hospitals. But that would have happened independent of whether or not they were being given homeopathic preparations, which we'll get to in a minute. Now, just to compare, now we have the modern germ theory of disease, okay, which we can use to treat people. We now understand that cholera is caused by a nasty little bacterium, okay, and with modern oral rehydration and antibiotic treatments, patients have a less than 1% mortality rate if you get to them in time. That's tremendous, okay, that's better than both of these. Okay, so that shows you the difference of what the germ theory of disease has accomplished now in the more than a century since these kinds of outbreaks were common in parts of London. Okay. Now another, here's the linguistic part. So in order to distinguish itself from then conventional medicine, which was pretty barbaric, let's be honest, homeopathy was put in distinction to something which Hahnemann referred to as allopathy, which means all the other stuff. Okay, so all the other medicine. So this is a cute linguistic trick. You'll see this used a lot by peddlers of pseudoscience. They use a word to label the opposition. This is a common political tactic, right? If you can label the opposition, you can define the debate. All right, so this is not limited to only politics. This works in medicine and science and other places where people want to inject their ideas but don't want to do any actual work to test them. All right, so he wanted to distinguish himself from standard medicine, and so we have this word. It's lasted until today. So, and the catch here is that no person who practices evidence-based medicine refers to what they do as allopathy. That's a label put on them by the homeopathic community. So if you ever hear somebody talking about allopathic medicine, put that in your BS detector toolkit. That's a warning bell that this person may already be biased toward homeopathy and far away from evidence-based medicine. Okay? And you do this so that it can appear on a debate platform to be an equally valid method with its own naming convention. Okay? All right, so homeopathy, what cures what? The basic premise is that you can take a substance that induces the same symptom set as the disease, you don't care what the disease is actually caused by, and then you can give that that to a person diluted. And the more diluted it is, according to Hahnemann's own nomenclature, the more potent the homeopathic treatment is, which flies in the face of chemistry and biology and physics. But nonetheless, that's the premise that Hahnemann set up, and it can be tested, right? Okay, you can actually test that claim. And who makes that claim today? Who makes the claim today that you can take a substance that induces the same symptom set, and you can use it to then cure the disease? So, yeah? Wow. Okay. Anyone want to say Republicans or Democrats or those damn Tories and Whigs? Anyone? No? No? I mean, a lot of people make this. You'll find it's not just libertarians. You'll find left-wing and right-wing people who make the same claim. And it sort of depends on whether they're talking about a family should have the right to treat its kids in any way they see fit, right, which is more on the right side of the spectrum. And on the left side of the spectrum, well, everybody's equally valid, and there are all these ancient medical secrets, and the medical community is just an establishment that's trying to suppress this information. Same outcome, different arguments, okay? Yeah?
Do you mean, like, vaccines? I mean, I know the virus is dead, but isn't that the...
That's a great question. Okay, so vaccines. Why are vaccines not homeopathic? All right, we'll come back to that. Yeah. Well, okay, you know the answer? Yeah?
They're dead.
Right. Okay. So the idea for a vaccination is that you take the thing that actually causes the disease, the virus, let's say, you make it inert, or in the modern era, a lot of what happens now is you just take the chemical compounds that trigger the immune response, and you give those to the immune system to prime it. So the next time it sees it, it fights it. Okay. So that's an active area of study as to whether that's actually any more effective than just giving the dead virus, which is harmless. Okay. Now, why is that different from homeopathy? It's a diluted, dead virus that you inject into a human being to trigger an immune response. And the difference, I'm sort of giving the punchline away, is it's a measurable dose. Okay? There's actually a measurable quantity, macroscopic on the scale of the immune system, that the immune system can see and respond to, which is in contradistinction to what you're going to see in homeopathy. Okay? So did you have a comment or a question? Or?
I guess I was just sort of thinking that.
Yeah.
Symptoms, but like if you were to do a vaccination, you actually found the cause of the illness. Like,
that could be one possibility. That maybe homeopathy is better at getting rid of the symptoms, but not actually curing the underlying cause, and that could be tested as well. Okay. There's also just the basic claim that it actually also treats the disease itself, and that can be tested as well. So, for instance, you can measure. You know, if you really wanted, I mean, you have to be careful because you want to not cross ethical boundaries. But if you have a patient that has cholera and two patients that have cholera, and you wanted to do a simple test, you could give one a homeopathic preparation and one, you know, you could give an actual like antibiotic and some water, right, and see what happens. And then measure the levels of cholera in their body over time to see if it's still multiplying or going down, okay? And keeping in mind, the body can fight cholera on its own, so you have to control for that. That's always, the human body is an incredibly powerful tool. And so you always have to factor that in. You always have to take into account the fact that a human immune system is already a very potent weapon against the world. Otherwise, we'd all be dead already. Okay. All right. So here's some popular people who make the claim. So this actually captures kind of everybody in one slide, which I like. So as much as I like Oprah Winfrey, you know, there are lots of people I like, but they still say dumb things every now and then. And unfortunately, she doesn't just say them. She gives people a platform to say dumb things, which in my mind is a lot worse. Okay. It's one thing to say them. It's another thing to enable them on a national stage. And so the dumb person that she gives a platform to is Dr. Mehmet Oz, who's an actual surgeon. I mean, he's a real physician, but on his own show now, he peddles all kinds of nonsense that falls under the category of homeopathy, all right? And I'll show you why it's nonsense today. All right, and then I love this. Here on his show, he was interviewing an author of a book called The Homeopathic Revolution, Why Famous People and Cultural Heroes Choose Homeopathy. I don't give a damn whether famous people or cultural heroes choose homeopathy. I care whether the medical community has established through repeated experimentation that it's better than the best existing medical intervention. And the punchline is, it isn't. It's no better than placebo, okay? So I don't really care. That's a great misdirection right there, right? That's, what is that called in terms of logical fallacies? Does anyone know what that is? Yeah?
Red herring.
What's that? Red herring? Okay, and then there's another one. So red herring is good. It's a bit of misdirection, right? Because then who cares what they think? I care what these doctors over here think. So
false consensus.
Popularity. Yeah, popularity. Yeah, everyone loves these people, and they love homeopathy. Why wouldn't you? Yeah, and then also appeal to authority, right? That somehow these are authority figures, right? Okay. So there's lots of logical fallacies in one sentence. It's great. Okay? Okay, so what do homeopathic medications look like? We're going to do two things today. We're going to show you store-bought ones, and we're going to make our own. Okay? Yeah, somebody knows where this is going, right? All right, so you can go on the web. Most reputable pharmacies no longer carry these, although until, what, 5 years ago, CVS? Walmart. Walmart's pharmacy used to carry homeopathic preparations.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I went in there to buy them once, and like I had done for the first 5 years of this course, couldn't find them on the shelf. So I found a pharmacist who had a PhD in pharmacy, and I asked her, where do you keep the homeopathic medicines? And she said, this is a quote, she said, "We don't sell that crap anymore." And I said, "Good for you, but I need some medicine."
Yeah, that's fantastic, but please, where can I find the homeopathic medicines?
She said,
medicine?
"Go to Whole Foods," and boy, was she right, Whole Foods has a million...
Yep, they have a whole section, which he took a picture of the other day. I didn't get to include it, but I have a receipt from them here. Now, I find this fascinating. The way you typically make a homeopathic preparation is you take the substance, you dilute it with water, and then you drip it onto a sugar pill. So what you're really taking is mostly a pill made of sugar, okay? And so if you take a look at this sleep relief here, which is supposed to help you fall asleep when you're anxious or you have insomnia, right? You pay about, the time I got this off the website, about $10 for this box of pills, 50 tablets, okay? As of November 8th of last year, the price had dropped to $7.99. But please keep in mind that these 50 tablets are 0.06 pounds of sugar. I'm not sure if that includes the box or not. But if you go to Walmart, you can buy a 3-pound bag of sugar for or a 1-pound bag of sugar for $3.
Wow.
Okay, 1-pound bag of sugar, $3. This is 0.06 pounds. And it's $8 last time I checked. For comparison, you can go to Walmart and get Tylenol PM, which I actually take to help me deal with the jet lag when I travel to Europe to work on my experiment. You get 50 tablets for $8. So about the same price, okay? But what are they charging you for about the same price when these homeopathic remedies are sold on the shelf? We'll get to that, all right? Now, this is the list of ingredients from this homeopathic sleep aid, okay? And how many people here are fans of the comic group Monty Python? Anyone? Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, that's trepidation. You can put your hand up. It's okay. No one's going to judge. It's fine. Yeah. We're all equals here. No one's judging.
I'm the only one who...
He's judging. But, you know, I mean, they're supposed to grade you, but I don't. Right? So, okay. If you take a look at this, you'll see that these ingredients have some very funny names that you probably, if you take a look at an actual bottle of pills, I mean, granted, those names can be impenetrable sometimes. But these sound made up, right? Arsenicum album, Coffea cruda, Nitricum acidum. There's a joke about a great friend in Rome that one of the characters, Pontius Pilate, in Life of Brian has. And I won't repeat it here because it's dirty. But it's made up. And it sounds made to sound like Latin, but it's not actually Latin. And that's sort of, when I look at this, I always think of that movie, Life of Brian. Oh, and by the way, it's got stevia leaf extract at the end, which is a sweetener, okay? All right, lactose, that's sugar. So there's sugar in this. And those are listed as inactive ingredients. All these other things are active ingredients. Now,
lactose will do something.
Yeah, lactose, if you're lactose intolerant, you probably don't want to take this. Actually, that's a really good point. I mean, unless you like to sleep and make obnoxious sounds while you do it. So, all right. So now, this is the ingredients list. But what does it mean? I mean, when you look at actual medical preparations, it'll say, you know, 5 milligrams of active ingredients. 5 milligrams, you can go into the lab and you can prep it. You can take it from a beaker, you can put it on a scale, you can figure out how much you have, you can get 5 milligrams. But these are 30 C, what are these, centimeters? Are these centigrade? What the hell is this? Okay. So what does 30 C mean? 30 C is actually the recommended preparation from Samuel Hahnemann for homeopathic medicines. So 30, big number. C, big letter. That must mean something big, right? Okay. So now comes the part of the lecture where we will talk about this scale and overdose intentionally on homeopathic medicine. And we're not really sure how to do that, and you'll see why in a minute. Okay? So the homeopathic potency scale is interesting. All right? The dilution ratio is always active ingredient to water. Okay? So one part active ingredient, So one part water, so maybe 1 liter water, 1 liter active ingredient, that's 1 to 1, and that's called the mother tincture, okay? If you now take the ingredient and dilute it 1 part to 10 parts water, so maybe 1 liter of water and 1/10 of a liter of active ingredient, shake those up, okay? That's called 1X, big X. Now, if you then dilute it 1 to 100, so 1 part ingredient, 100 parts water, that's 2X, or now we switch to the C scale, 1C, okay?
Latin again.
Yeah, Latin again, actual Latin in this case. So X is the Roman numeral 10, okay? And C, I forget the original Latin word. Does anyone know the original Latin word for 100? Centum? Centum? Yeah, okay, so centum is 100, right? Okay, 1 to 10,000. So that's 1 part in 100 in 100. That's 2C. See where this is going? Okay, 1 part in 10 to the 24, okay? So now for every 10 to the 24 molecules of water, you have 1 molecule of the active ingredient, that's 12C, highly potent.
Try to find it.
Highly potent. Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. This is the recommended dilution from Samuel Hahnemann, and it's very typical, although you'll see 12C and 6C preparations, okay? So this is 30C. These are 60 zeros after this one, and this is called high potency. High potency, okay? Does anybody know how many molecules or atoms of water are in about, I don't know, a typical container of water, like a terrestrially sized container? What's that?
Not that many.
Okay, but what's the number? Does anyone remember the number? High school chemistry. 6.02 times 10 to the
23,
and that's called whose number?
Avogadro's
number. That's right. If anyone ever asks you how many atoms of water are in this container, you just go Avogadro's number, and that's about right for most containers that we deal with on the human scale. That's actually a great number. It's maybe you're off by a factor of 10, but who cares, right? It's a big number. All right. Now Avogadro's number fits snugly within I think about one line of this line of zeros. Okay, so there are 60 total zeros here. All right, so that's about, what, 30 there, and so 24 is down here someplace. Okay, that's ridiculous. That means that in one container of water, there's not only less than 1 molecule of the active ingredient when you do 30C, you'd have to give millions of doses over billions of years just to get 1 molecule of the original active ingredient. Now, our immune system is bombarded daily by things that we don't intentionally put there, okay, but we're not constantly being cured of coughing because of smog in the air, all right? Otherwise, our friend over there would be better, okay? Although maybe he's either dead now or he's in a quiet phase, one of the two. All right. You're not dead, are you?
Close.
Okay, he's moving. That's good enough for me. It's the residual brain activity after death. It's fine. It's fine. Okay. Now, the homeopathic sleep remedy that we have in class today, this is the one we used last year. Here's the receipt from Whole Foods. I bought it for $10. $10, that magic number, right? This was 200C Caffea Crudea, caffeine. Okay? Caffea Crudea is caffeine. 200C. 200C, one with 400 zeros after it, of water molecules to 1 molecule of active ingredient. There are not 1 with 400 zeros of water molecules anywhere in the cosmos. You'd have to have multiple universes to even begin to make this an active dilution, okay? All right, so we have that here, right? Yeah, that's not correct. That's more correct, all right? All right, so we have this here, and I would just like you to verify, Ramsha? Right, okay, so you were the role of the die winner for verifying, is it sealed?
Yes.
Okay, and what's the preparation? Can you find the C scale on there? It's on the big label. Flip it around,
okay,
there you go.
200C.
200C, okay, so this is 200C. What's that? Oh, what's the K? Do we know what that is?
Yes, it's a method of preparation. You can either stir it or you can bang it against the piece of leather.
Yeah, that's right. You can have it shaken or stirred. So we all know how James Bond prefers his homeopathy, right? All right. Okay, so what we're going to do is...
There's an H and there's a K. H is Hahnemann and K is some other crackpot.
Yeah, actually, why don't you go ahead and twist the cap gently and break the seal on that and open that up. Okay. We have more?
There's some empties that I'll pass around. Please give me the bottles back, though, when you're done.
I was wrong, by the way. It's 5 pounds of sugar is $3 at Walmart. 5 pounds. So I was off by a factor of 5, but meh, you know. Here's the stuff that we're passing around now, okay, to have a look at here. Okay, so this is the 200C. There's the K. That's the way it's prepared, either shaken or stirred. Okay. All right, and then my favorite is this one, which I guess we can't get anymore, but it's called Calms Forte.
Oh,
and,
we could. It tastes terrible.
Oh, okay. And then what do you notice about it? It's labeled with what here? Landon, can you see that? John, you're in the way.
Non-drowsy.
Non-drowsy formula for a sleep aid. What? Okay, so again, the BS detector should be just right now, all right? If you want to sleep, you damn well want a drowsy formula, okay? All right, so are you guys trying to crack open that bottle? Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to overdose on this medicine, okay? The problem is we don't actually know how to overdose on homeopathic medicine because dilution is more potent. So who's overdosing? The person who pops the whole bottle of pills or the person who licks a single pill? We don't know. Maybe we should toss it in the ocean and come back and drink a cup of seawater later. We don't know. I mean, the reality is if this is the argument, absent any evidence, then what? How do you get more of it? Do you take less of it? If I take none of it, will I sleep forever?
Which one of us is gonna?
Oh, I'll tell you. You take the big dose. I'll lick a pill, because I have to do the next thing.
Good. I don't have
bastard.
They taste terrible.
All right, so yes, there's
believing.
A little sugar pill there, right?
When you tell this story to your friends and your parents, and you say, oh, Dr. Scalise took a whole vial of medicine, I don't even take aspirin. If I thought there was any medicine in this vial, I wouldn't do this. But I know this is homeopathic.
Yeah, do not do this with actual medical preparations. We just do this either because we're really stupid or
we
know something, right?
Dave?
Can I get you something? Can I get you something warm to wash that down with?
No.
What is that? Oh,
the recommended dose is 2 pills. So I took 50 minus 1. I took 49.
Yeah. I actually took the whole pill. I licked it, but why not? I'll just take the pill.
Exceeded the recommended dosage by a factor of 25.
Yeah. Now, would anyone want to volunteer to come by Professor Scalise's office? Are you going to be around later today?
Well, he'll be
my friend. And make sure he's still awake.
He will be.
Okay, so that's fine. We went out to the store, we went to Whole Foods, thanks to Professor Scalise and his credit card. We got $10 worth of sugar, and that's the most expensive sugar to price ratio I think I've ever paid, or now he's paid, okay? That's one way to do it, but... So we already kind of went over the typical question, how many atoms are in a typical container? Okay, yeah. Here's the part of the lecture where we demonstrate homeopathic dilution, okay? So, I have water. Line those up. And what we've done is we've got some water, some of this nice market pantry stuff from Target. It's about a quarter of a liter per bottle. Okay, so each of these is about a quarter of a liter. And I'm gonna use an eyedropper to begin a preparation of homeopathic medicine. What would urine treat? I don't know. What happens when you drink urine? Does anybody know? Because I guess we're going to find out. Oh, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Please, do share it with the class.
It was used in the Iberian Peninsula in Roman times as a tooth cleaner.
Oh, as a tooth cleaner, yeah. And actually, you'll find uric acid preparations in like rosacea and acne creams. Okay, so I have acne, and I need to cure it. And I guess I'm going to do that by, So we have one drop of fluid. I'm going to use an eyedropper to get my one part active ingredient, and I'm going to use a bottle of water to get my so many parts water for the dilution. I like my urine shaken, not stirred. So I'm going to pop one of those open. Let's see here, we have. Does anyone want to check the beaker to make sure it's warm? No. Wants to do that. I'll tell your parents, I can't believe we're paying this much money and he drank his own pee. Well, I'm going to put one drop in, but honestly, I mean, if we wanted each of these, if I put a, well, actually, hang on. Let's see if I can get more in here. That's good enough. I estimated that if I put one eyedropper entirely full of this in that bottle of water, that's about a 1C preparation, okay? So I'm going to put that in there. Ooh, look at that. It discolored it and everything. And I'm going to shake that. Could you start opening bottles, please?
And if you want to do it the Hahnemann way, you have to do it 10 times in this direction, 10 times in that direction, 10 times in this direction.
Yeah, we're just going to speed this along for the purposes of class. Okay, so No deception. Let's put that right there in front of you. Just so you know, I'm not fooling, nothing up my sleeves. Okay.
That's a different eyedropper, yes?
Yes, different. Yes. Not an idiot. Well, okay, so that's bottle number one. Okay, and then we'll. Two, good enough.
That process of shaking is called succussion. They made up a word.
You have to do it 10 times this way, and 10 times this way, and 10 times this way.
We're not going to clean cap. Thank you. I mean, I don't want to be foul about this, right? It's just disgusting. Is he really going to drink his own pee? We will find out.
So, what kind of preparation is this? What number and letter preparation is this? Six bottles, each diluted by a factor of 100. It's how much? 6C, or if you do it on the X scale, how many X? 6C is how many X?
12.
12X. So let's figure out how much there's going to be in the final preparation. So 6C
sorry about that.
Is 12X.
Get stuff all over your nice desk. Here. I wouldn't touch that.
That's one part in 10 to the 12. That's a trillion. One part in a trillion. So it's one part medicine.
Seat down if that makes anybody feel better.
One part urine.
Is that it? We're all done?
A trillion parts water.
Oh, we're all done? Okay.
I think one part in a trillion is below the detection limit of most modern instruments.
Okay, so need a sugar pill. Need a sugar pill. Landon, come on. Here's John. Open that up. Help an old man. Real? Oh, you're going to bust the knife out and stab it? They're just serious. What do they do to you? Thanks. I'll pick one. Okay. So now, to do the preparation, we just have to take.
Anybody else want to try it? Archer, ladies and gentlemen.
Got some more.
Sticky.
Refreshing.
Yeah. Now, would I have done that if I really thought there was even a molecule of urine left in that thing?
Yeah.
We're into some sick crap in the physics department. I'll tell you. No. I wouldn't have done that. You're okay? You're comfortable with this stuff? That's okay? No. You're not going to sue?
No.
Right.
There's more urine in tap water when you turn on your tap. There's more urine than that.
Anyone want a drink of water? It's probably safer than what's coming out. So.
There's arsenic, there's lead, there's a lot of stuff in your regular tap water. And at such a small dose, it's perfectly fine.
Okay. All right, so what might the world look like if homeopathy was allowed to sort of run free? It flies in the face of biology and chemistry and physics that less than a molecule, in fact, 1/100 billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a molecule has any effect whatsoever on your immune system in helping you fight disease or anything else like that. Vaccines, on the other hand, will have, you know, micrograms of dead virus in it, an actual measurable amount that you can then use to prime the immune system. This wasn't micrograms. This was something bordering on, you know, one in like two molecules in Avogadro, or femtograms or something like that. It's smaller than an atom, basically. Okay? So what might the world look like if it was dominated by pseudoscience? Let's find out.
What have we got?
Okay,
broken
arms, spectrum internal injuries,
making
choosing to the head.
Okay, let's move fast. Put your solution larger to Montana,
stank.
One part in a million.
Sure, serious.
You're right. We need to check with those. One part in 10 million.
Holy
doctor. Cheeky one.
Definitely fine, Handel. Get me some wolfsbane, also known as monkshood, in here. And a whole tray of flower remains.
Oh, your chakras are fading. We need some crystals.
Yes, fresh some purple tinted quartz. Right. Make that aquamarine quartz.
Cool.
Okay, he's stabilizing. Now, does anybody know what sort of car this is?
Blueford Mondeo, apparently.
Right, get me a bit of Blueford Mondeo. Put it in water, shake it, dilute it, shake it again, dilute it again. Do some more shaking, dilute it some more. Now put 3 drops on his tongue. If that doesn't cure him, I don't know what will.
Look at this, Simon.
What is it?
Don't think this poor chap's got long to live.
What else?
His lifeline. He's short. His horoscope's not too clever either. Sagittarius. Brace yourself for a surprise. Things are about to change for you.
So they are, unless... Wait.
What?
We could try drawing a bit more lifeline on with Byron. You got a better idea? Let's see what happens. Time of death, 3:34. Bitch.
Tough day, eh?
I just can't stand losing them.
It happens.
I don't know, sometimes I think a trace solution of deadly nightshade or a statistically negligible quantity of arsenic just isn't enough.
That's crazy talk, Simon. Okay, so you killed the old patient with cancer or heart disease, or bronchitis, flu, chickenpox, or measles. But when someone comes in with a vague sense of unease, or a touch of the nerves, or even just more money than sense, you'll be left with a bottle of basically just water in one hand, and a huge invoice in the other.
I suppose you're right.
I know. Want a drink?
I need one.
Excuse me. Two more homeopathic lockers, please.
Whoa, that's strong stuff.
Okay. Have a good weekend. This is the 5C solution. Cheers.
Yep. Thank you. Enjoy.